Good day, everybody. I'm Terry.
I'm going to start before everybody leaves. And just the last person to turn the lights off, please. First of all, apology for me. I've only really kind of just arrived at the afternoon tea, and that's because I was in an ethics committee meeting that went 90 minutes over time. Now, that's got to be unethical, hasn't it? So apologies for that. There's plenty of papers I didn't want to see. We can keep it as informal as we like. I certainly don't want to talk at you at this hour of the afternoon. So I'm going to get some basic stuff covered, and then I would like some input from you if you don't mind. The story behind what I'm going to try and cover today, I'll see how I go time-wise, is I work in a forensic psychology program. I used to work in a criminology program. Blending those two things together interests me. And I have a lot of graduate students, two of which are here, and they're working in and around, whether it's offender rehab or offender reintegration, and around these kinds of things. And the more we read about it, the more vague we get, the more cloudy it gets, the more unclear we get. We're not sure about the concept itself, we're not sure what it looks like, we're not sure what makes up its constituent elements, how to measure it, etc., etc. So today, it's really just about giving you a sense of where we're at with that, but hopefully trying to raise perhaps some of the debates that you'll see in the literature and stuff anyway, in some kind of brief distillation. So I want to talk about the limits of the criminal justice response. I'm going to super briefly, because I know that's been probably the theme of the day. The renewed focus on reintegration and desistance, and we'll get some term clarity around that, some of the controversies around that, and then a model that we've presented about, which we think is a way to perhaps conceptualise reintegration and offender desistance, which I think somehow helps some clarity around some of this stuff. And then a little bit about the research. I know when Jess and Delaney introduced themselves, I said they just handed in theses. Congratulations to those guys, by the way. About this stuff, and they've certainly snapped off sizable portions of the big project, and I'll give you a little bit of information about that as well. Some data, just let me know if you've seen it already today, but the bottom line is imprisonment rate has gone up about 20% in 10 years. It's a huge increase, right? Look at that second one. 58% of all current prisoners have served time before. 58% of people that we're processing out saying, we think that, you're ready to leave and whatever it was we wanted to do with you has been done, 58% are returning. And 40% of those within 2 years. It's a powerful stat. The number of people re-entering prison is bigger than the number of first-time clients. Are we getting it right? Doesn't look like it. Unless, like other businesses, we're trying to generate repeat customers. So what we see here as a result of scrutinising that data is, okay, nobody denies that prison is punitive. I hope not, anyway. We say, oh, yeah, but these days we have a kind of a rehabilitative ethos, etc., etc. Yes, but it's a rehabilitative ethos within prison. But we have whole programs and systems of rehabilitation, some of which I know you've heard about today, in place. And we say, okay, so at best we can say punishment plus rehabilitation, and someone else might want to say, well, it's actually rehabilitation minus the effects of punishment, which is another way to think of it because it gets in the way, but equals this. And the output is what we just saw before, which is not so great. We're not kicking some major goals there. So people have said, all right, okay, what else is there? There's punishment, there's rehab, deterrence, risk management. We seem not so good at deterrence. We seem good at risk management while they're locked up, but not so great afterwards. And that perhaps leads us to this question of what happens afterwards? What about the social? What about the psychosocial? What about this notion of interaction? As he's just talked about it then, when you get out, what happens then? What do I do? Do I give up my friends? Do I have to give up all this other stuff? Doing a bit of media lately, and I said to one guy, I love it when journalists just push record and then they start looking out the window and stuff. It's hard, it's like you feel like I'm the most boring person in the world. Anyway, he asked a question and he's looking out the window, and then about halfway through it I said, the whole notion of having served your time is a misnomer. The whole notion of being able to say I've paid my debt to society is a misnomer in our society because you just keep paying, right? At this point, he was a bit awake. Oh, it's kind of an interesting point, And I was like, oh, wow. After 40 minutes, I've made this guy kind of come to life. It's some kind of throwaway line. And it didn't even make it into the piece anyway. But this is, to me, one of these points, isn't it? It's like, I don't know if you have clients, I certainly used to have them, who used to use lines like that. I've paid my debt to society, and used to say, well, actually, pal, keep reaching into your pocket, because society is going to expect you to keep paying for a long, long time. You know, and I use the course example of the older football player on suspension who comes back. If you return from suspension for whatever code it is, 3 weeks, 6 weeks suspension, for whatever it was that you did, the club doesn't say restricted access to the gym. The club doesn't say restricted access to training. The club doesn't say you can't hang around with those two guys. When you run back on the field, the other players don't say, we're not playing with him. Because there's a whole notion of, you served your time, you're 6 weeks for biting a guy's ear off or whatever it was, and nothing happened to you, did it? It's a fascinating narrative in sport. You just, 6 weeks, you can't play. You bit some guy's nose off, or you did something really kind of feral. You run back on the field, hey, here he's back, you know, it's all good, it's all good. Let's see how he bounces back. Nobody goes, he shouldn't be allowed to play anymore. It's a fascinating kind of thing. We can seem to be able to do it in sport when there's an investment in getting them back on. But over here in everyday life, they seem to have forfeited their rights to do anything, and it's just kind of normalised, mates. This look towards the social asks these kinds of questions. What is it about when they get out that is making it more likely that they'll return? I like it because it's less of a focus on cause, isn't it? This whole notion, what caused you to commit crime? Why are you sitting here right now? Why do you have the job you're having right now? We can't answer those questions. We develop a life story about it, don't we? But we ask people, what caused crime? They can't answer it. We can't find that stuff out. Instead, we just go, look, you've got a problematic behaviour. How do we help you stop it? How do we put that in place? You know, when you go to quit smoking, no one goes, forget that, let's drill into why you started in the first place. You know what I mean? Unless you go into a psychoanalyst to stop smoking. But, you know, this is the whole notion of just like, okay, forget all that stuff. Let's just focus on cessation, desistance. It's kind of AA model. So we see this focus on desistance, and we see a focus on this thing we call reintegration. And these terms are flying around left, right and centre. Well, what do they mean, and how do you construct them, and how do you measure them? Well, it ain't easy. Definitions. Every article you read, every piece you read, every professional organisation pamphlet you read will have a slightly different twist on what reintegration is. Well, wouldn't it be great if we said, well, let's look to see what the law says. Well, unfortunately, we've done that audit, and there's no reintegration is not a formal goal of sentencing in any Australian jurisdiction, in any sentencing act in Australia. They use the term a lot, though, and they use it in kind of wacky ways. We're in the process of writing this piece at the moment about it, because we're trying to divide the mentions into a number of categories. You know, reintegration that looks like real integration mentioned in the legislation. Reintegration that looks like kind of something else, or reintegration that looks like rehabilitation. In our sentencing acts and corrections acts, we have phrases that say things like, the offender needs to be reintegrated by doing a violence program. You know, and you go, hang on, what's their understand what reintegration means? They say, oh, we'll do a violence program. I guess if you drill down into that, it might help you reintegrate, but isn't that more about rehab that they're talking about there? And isn't that sort of a clinical focus? I'll ask you about that in a second. Programs or initiatives or organisations that are designed to assist to reintegration. Fantastic, we need them, they're doing great work. But there is 10,000 of them, and what they share in common is probably smaller than the ways that they differ. And that might be a problem when we're trying to work out what the effect of this thing that we call reintegration is on reoffending. It also gives me a rash because it reminds me of, for those who have been around long enough, late 70s, early 80s with rehabilitation. Rehabilitation, Martinson's famous meta-analysis of rehabilitation in 74? He did a meta-analysis of 300 evaluation studies in rehabilitation across Western systems and said, what works in offender rehabilitation? And his answer was, nothing. Nothing. No program made a meaningful effect on rehabilitation and on reoffending. And he said it was because let's look at this slide. Rehabilitation is up against it in the early 80s because there's different ideas of what it is. There's lots of different programs being run without a lot of empirical support. They're being run by professionals from a variety of different fields. We lack a real theoretical framework. Uh-oh, I'm seeing history repeating itself with another RE word, this time reintegration. I think we are at a flashpoint with reintegration where if we don't work out what it is and just instead pick it up and just run with it, we'll be in some real trouble.
because the risk signs are there. This looks a lot like rehab did when Martinson reviewed it and said it's not working. Since then, they've really reeled it in, haven't they? There's all rules about rehabilitation now, risk, need, responsivity, and think of all that stuff what you like. But it's now got rules and parameters around it. What is the relationship between rehabilitation and reintegration?
They sound the same.
I'd be interested in your input. Here's, I've got a bit of colour and movement for you before I ask you. I don't know what's happened to my formatting there. Are they unrelated processes? Does one happen, and then after that's sorted, do you move to the next one? Do they overlap a bit? Do you have to get some of this before you can get some of that? Is rehabilitation a component of reintegration? Reintegration is a bigger picture, but you've got to fix that stuff first. Is it the other way around? Can you never say you're fully rehabilitated until you've been reintegrated? Submissions invited right from right now, please. I'll be curious to hear the room's thoughts of people who are in there at the coal face thinking about stuff. I'd be interested. We all differ on it.
Using the term re-entry a lot these days.
Yep. And tell me why that's a plus.
Easier to understand.
Less syllables.
Well, I mean, it's
but what does it mean?
It is what it says.
But what does it mean?
What does it mean?
Is it the physical act of me walking back into the room? Is this re-entry?
It's just the process. And then hopefully have a one-way process, a return process.
Yeah, I think the term is just as problematic at some levels, but...
Mind you, you can re-enter both ways, can't you?
Exactly.
So you can re-enter out into society, and then you can re-enter prison.
Yep.
So, is it a good word?
Yeah.
Because...
That's right.
It could mean either one.
If you go, if you hear US people talk about recidivism, they talk about re-entry rates. Re-entry. They're talking about system return. So there's a problem there, but there's also a problem in terms of, like, is it that moment when I walk out with my old luggage and my suit that's come back into fashion, or is it, you know, whatever it is?
Really, you know, like, if you're talking about through care or rehabilitation or reintegration, they're all supposed to mean...
Yeah.
Stuff's happened to you.
Exactly. Yeah.
Whereas re-entry is like, oh, we're just booting you out now.
Yeah.
Bye.
Yeah. Re-entering society.
Bye. We don't want you.
Yeah.
Good luck.
Surely if somebody's fully reintegrated back into society, they're
re-entering
into society. They're rehabilitating. So I think you get it right
the most. Okay. Is there an argument that, because that's a powerful one in the literature as well, is there an argument that in this room here of offenders, you know, here we are, that maybe there's three of us that don't need any rehabilitation. Maybe all we needed was reintegration. Maybe we didn't have any personal big problems or whatever that's driving our offending. We fell out because we were marginalised or whatever, and if we can just get, you know, unmarginalised, we'll be back on board. Maybe I didn't have some personal deficit or abundance in me that needed to be fixed. Don't we think there's a lot of clients that we deal with that don't necessarily need to be fixed?
That's only if we go to a deficit focus.
Yeah.
And we've got to stop doing that.
Yeah. But isn't rehabilitation all about a deficit focus?
No.
Yes.
No. That's a choice of a practitioner.
Okay. So if I am... Isn't the definition of rehabilitation fixing something that's wrong with me?
No. Rehabilitation should be about identifying the strengths somebody has and enhancing them rather than doing your drilling bit that I can't do into forensics. Okay. So I come back to what I just said. So to fully reintegrate into the community as a so-called normal functioning human being, which I trust I'm surrounded by because there's no security here, then I need some sort of positive rehabilitation to build up something that I'm missing. Otherwise, what the hell am I doing?
What was that last phrase? To build up something that what?
Something that I may be missing.
And didn't you say you didn't want to be deficit focused?
I don't want that focus.
All right. This is where I think, because you're talking Tony Ward, Good Lives, and I think this is fantastic, right? And they say, we're not into deficit focus, but I think it's mumbo jumbo, the language. I like the model, but they're saying we need to work out what they've got and maximise it, because isn't the rest of the sentence, because they haven't got it enough yet, i.e. it's a deficit?
Yeah,
you know what I mean? Am I being too much of a wise guy there? Or?
I think
not at all.
The example that you attempted to illustrate there is a bit of a throw line in my humble view. About four or five people, and in that room of four or five people, maybe two of them don't actually need any rehabilitation because whatever it was that made them fall into their criminogenic behaviour doesn't need rehabilitating.
Yep.
I mean, again, I think, you know, you kept relating into your earlier part of your opening of your presentation about digging down. And I think in terms of rehabilitation, for example, I think, again, you've got to have the sorts of evaluation processes that determine whether a person, what a person requires in terms of that rehabilitation. And so there's a whole lot of factors I think you take into consideration there. To me, I'm tending to agree with my colleague here in terms of reintegration, because I think reintegration for me, as I observe it, in the things that we've kind of try to do with our organisation, is kind of the last step of trying to say, well, look, you know, the things that we've had to address in rehabilitation, I think you've pretty well got them mastered now, and now it's about the reintegration, so we're going to put these into action.
Yeah.
And I think there is a subtle difference, and that's just my observation.
Mm. And the difference, dare I say, is focus. It's not about denial. There's no... having an emphasis on positive reinforcement, if you like, rather than deficit, is not an excuse for denying a deficit, but it is about focusing on the positive.
Mm.
That's the critical difference.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's a much faster pathway.
It's a much faster pathway. And it's rooted in one simple truth, and that is you can't change the past.
Yeah.
So what it is.
The question that keeps me up at night, with my work anyway, PhD stuff, is when is an offender no longer
an offender?
Is it when I say, when they say, when authority figures say? Like, when you're a prisoner, when you're a prisoner, and then you're an ex-prisoner, or a former incarcerated prisoner, whatever you want to say, but when are you no longer an offender? Because people get called offender forever.
Yeah.
It's recorded forever.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know.
The answer to that, if you like.
If you're focusing on reintegration, how is that possible for someone where that does happen?
But they're always labelled an offender. Well, you know, I've been out of prison,
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. And this comes back to another debate, which is coming up in a few slides' time, which is, you know, when has one desisted? When has one stopped? You know, let's apply it to any other walk of life. You might, as any ex-smokers in the room?
I've been an ex-smoker.
Yeah. You've been an ex-smoker. Okay. You re-entered the system. lapse and relapse are part of the cycle. But, you know, felt like one lately?
Absolutely.
I'll join you that one. You know, I haven't had been a serious smoker for years, but the last few months I'm thinking, yeah, smoking was great. Have we desisted? Yeah, well, behaviourally we have. But it's an ongoing struggle, isn't it?
Yeah.
We kind of have different ways of dealing with some of this stuff, though, don't we? See, I gave up smoking about 15 to 20 years ago now, but you know, nearly every day I feel like a smoker.
Sure.
And
let's go and have one now. Let's go and have one now and talk about it.
But you know what? Well, I can have one at my choice.
Mm-hmm.
Without actually doing the physical thing. Because I can just go and join a crowd who are smoking.
Yeah.
And I'm getting a nice waft. And I'm having a smoke.
Yeah.
And that's all I need. I don't need any more of that.
But if we apply that to this domain, you'll be charged with associating and you'll be back inside.
That's right.
Yeah, again. And this, I think this introduces another element of the debate to some extent, in my view. Because one of the things that I think most of us in this business have been challenged with is that there's always someone else out there that decide what the headline is.
Mm.
You know, and that is, then we have to attempt to, how could I describe this? Attempt to come to a point where, I understand it fully myself now I've got to go and work with my work colleagues so that they understand what this is all about, in the hope then that we meet all the KPIs in terms of the proposal that we put up in the the successes that we have in the agreements that we get, you know, that we sign off on. And I found that, you know, there have been successive, if you like, political interference in terms of the kind of journeys, pathways in our lives to such an extent that it doesn't give some of us time to catch up and make sure we do something well enough. Mm-hmm. And before you know what, there's something else that's, you know, again, the political system's come up with and said, no, look, I want you, this is the process that I want you to deal with, this is a pathway that I want you to take, and yada, yada, yada.
Well, before we only have to rehabilitate, now we have to rehabilitate and reintegrate.
That's right, which is, of course, another bigger debate about, is it us that has to reintegrate?
And not only that, you've got to do all that through through care, yeah?
Yeah, that's right.
And then through care is about taking somebody, again, this is, as I understand the Commonwealth's definition of it, that it's somebody less than a 12-month sentence, or they could be entering the cycle of 12 months left of their incarceration. And then you've got to get them to sign off that they're happy to work with you. You do your evaluations, of course. And then you've got to get the system, you've got to accept the system's referral of the client to work with them through care. I mean, there's gates all over the place. And it's not easy for people working in the business, because it's a business that most people don't want to have much to do with, and they certainly don't want to throw dollars at it. And we all experience that.
Even if there is 38,000
children
in Australia, because of that.
But, you know, we use all these words and all these acronyms, and it all gets rather tiring, and then we change it all every 3 or 4
years.
That's right.
We're rebranding.
The bottom line is, like me with my smoking, I'm a smoker. I've gone all day today without a cigarette. But don't worry, you'll get your waft later on.
Sorry to bring it up.
But I'm thinking of giving up. But guess who's going to make that decision? And guess who's going to be reintegrated into the non-smoking society, having had a positive attitude through my rehabilitative efforts? Me. And yes, my doctor has helped, and Champix has too. But that was my choice, ultimately. And let's not delude ourselves into thinking that we fix anything. It's the clients that fix themselves at the end. So I still think you got the last one right.
Absolutely. And this is this interaction, isn't it?
And we can help them get there, but we will never get them there.
Yeah.
Let's not delude ourselves into ever thinking that.
Yeah.
Because you'll never stop me smoking by telling me it's going to cost me $20 a day or whatever, all the nonsense I've been told. That means nothing to me. I'll get there because I want to, when I want to. And that's no different with the prisoners or any situation.
Yeah, that's right. This individual readiness and ability to change is something we talk about in our model. But community can play either an encouraging or a discouraging role.
And can I add to that? So hence one of my favourite sayings. What anybody thinks of me is none of my business. So a person has to get strong enough to, if we want to use this new word reintegration, and you can change it next year, that's okay.
Well, it's been around since the 80s. It's been fairly stable. It's just back, you know, it's just...
Vote, yeah. In and out of vote.
Yes, you know, exactly.
An individual has to be strong enough not to be swayed by anything.
Yeah, but that you know, it's very neoliberal, isn't it? It implies a level of agency on my part. You know, okay, I am determined not to reoffend. I am determined not to do that stuff. And I walk out to, here's filling in the first application for a rental, rental or property, and that first question is, have you ever?
Yes.
And if they're too not even front enough to ask that, they'll say, list your last residences for the last 10 years. You know what I mean? And then I go for the job, and there's that first question again. You know what I mean? This keeps coming at me. This is getting harder and harder. This is every friend of yours saying, we're all having one, man. You don't have fun anymore. You're not the same you used to be. Yeah, we're not inviting you anymore because you're down on smoking. We don't want to hang around with you anymore. Get out of here. We've got to come to parties. You know, this is something else beyond your strength and resilience. And we as a society are doing things to systematically make it harder for these people to desist.
But if I could just mention a scenario. Look, I think this gentleman over here wants to speak. No, offer it after you.
Oh. If you go back to the analogy that you made so well before about the sporting situation, and we're starting to talk about community at the moment. The other day I Googled crime and community agency. Nothing came up. And I think this is where we've got to start looking. Is when we're starting to get the support from the community about resistance, just the same as you'll get the support from your family about stopping smoking, I think that's where we're going to start heading.
And that is about reinforcement. That is not about making them walk through a minefield every day, and then when they step on one, saying, I knew you'd stuff up, you know what I mean? It's make it systematically harder for people, then they'll systematically return to the system. Mm-hmm. What were you going to say, Jess? Jess had a hand up as well.
Yeah, no, that's all right.
I was just going to say that today we've heard about a bunch of rehabilitation programs, and they have all very much focused on giving something to the offender, teaching them new skills, or delving back into their past, and that one by Mary about women who've been assaulted as when they were young. So it was all about going right back in time and addressing that thing that happened and why has that then caused them to offend, or having that one about with the program where people were making the t-shirts, it was teaching them skills, how to interact, and it was all about like adding things onto the offender, but there wasn't so much the focus on just learning how to not commit crime. It was just all about adding skill or going back into the past. And I think that's where this difference between rehab and reintegration is that the reintegration focus is really on learning how to not commit crime, how to lead your life after that.
Yeah, and how the community can assist that process.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It doesn't make it any easier what you were saying about society setting you up to fail. From a Canberra point of view, so many people say, I'm going to be on parole, but I can't leave Canberra. There's only one nightclub in Canberra.
There's not any nightclubs in Canberra.
They're saying, where can we go with our parole system? And I think in Canberra, I'm not sure, but I think it's one of the only jurisdictions where you can be on parole for 150 years, but if you step up on the 149th day, that doesn't count.
Yep, no, they do that here too.
None of you, and to me,
Victoria's Home Corrections Act.
Into the system, I found that.
Yeah.
That's setting people up to fail. Yep. How many of us make one mistake
exactly.
in 2 years' time?
Yep. With that level of supervision.
And lose everything.
It's like in New Zealand, you know, if your criminal act was 7 years ago, then it's wiped.
Yep.
And you get to start again. So
yep.
if you don't reoffend within those 7 years,
yes.
you don't have a criminal record anymore, you know. It's fine.
Let's talk
about it. You know, I can remember interviewing a middle-aged woman for a job, and you know, it's Hungry Jack's, you know, and you've got to fill out the form, and it says about the criminal conviction, and she said, oh, you know, I said, why? And she said, I got busted with some pot when I was 17. I mean, the woman's 40. Like, do I care? Anymore?
Yeah.
You know, why is it on the form anyway?
Yeah.
That's my question.
Yeah.
You know, so. Because, people lie. I mean, and we don't do police checks for run-of-the-mill jobs like that anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it broke my heart when my son-in-law finally got an interview for a job and he was doing the induction training, it was all happening, and then they said, and you'll need to bring a police check.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I was like, right, well, that's it.
Yeah. we saw a fascinating one at the CRIM conference down in Geelong the other day. The number of checks on CrimTrack, which is the way that you can check up organisations can pay a fee and have people checked up on, has increased by 500% in 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
And they did the people doing this study up in Queensland or something. They then talked to employers in focus groups and said, "So, okay, hey, why are you doing that?" And they went to cover our butts, you know, because we need to be seen to be, because now we're worried about other employers going, I didn't know that he used to it, dot, dot, dot. You know, I know I'm going to take the organisation, I'll go on stress leave and I'll do everything else, right? B, they said, it's really bad because when we find out anything, whether it is pot at 17 and they're 42, we feel like we can't employ them because, again, now we are knowingly doing it.
Yeah.
And so they feel obliged to do it for risk management, and then when they find out, it amplifies the risk management. So as a result, but the checks statistics were terrifying. You know, the number of
people who are checking this stuff up now who weren't in the past.
I think that really matches what Gary said initially, that the fear of crime is going up dramatically, but the actual crime is going down.
Yeah.
Because I know employees that even check Facebook.
Yeah. Oh,
like
yeah.
They check new employees or potential employees' Facebook page, and if there's any photos of them drunk on the weekend, that's gone. See you later. Well, that's what I mean. Like,
you'd be shocked at the stories I hear about this stuff.
Yeah.
A lot of this stuff's not limited to the criminal situation, the prisoner situation. Mm. On those same kinds of forms, have you ever been on WorkCover? Have you ever had an insurance?
That's what I said.
Have you had any
bankruptcy?
Have you ever been bankrupt? Mm-hmm. Now, bankruptcy is for life. Mm.
Do you have any?
It's recorded for life. Mm. So, you know, there's a lot of things.
Yeah.
That's a big topic.
Yeah, but you know, those ones you can see for whatever reason. Those are risk assessments as well, aren't they? And it's about what they call anamnestic prediction. They look at the past to work out the future, and it's a reliable predictor a lot of the time. But here we're saying, but this is going to lead to production of the problem. Do you know what I mean? If you ask someone about offending and then you don't employ them, and then you don't give them housing, and then the data are clear, these things make it more likely that you'll reoffend. So asking someone about back pain doesn't give them back pain. Asking someone about their offender and then not giving them the job is likely to contribute to their reoffending. Mm. And whenever you get a real disagreement in the room around this stuff, it happens sometimes, probably won't happen today, but you can say, listen, it's great that we all feel really strongly about it and we have a shared goal, right? And they're like, what are you talking about, shared goal? We've been throwing bricks at you and you've been ducking your diving. And I say, but we're all interested in reducing reoffending. And everybody's interested in doing that. And so if you could produce this data, you just have to work out what part of it you are a fan of and what part of it you want to work in and around. Let's proceed and see how far we get here. As we said, overlapping process, unrelated processes, is going backwards. Why is that then? If you watch it go through its thing again, sorry, little amoebas. So in the process of working in our team around it, we had to make some decisions about what to do. And so, like it or not, but this is kind of, you know, you can say, oh, I'm not a fan of that, but we had to sit down in meetings and go, what's our argument here? So we're going to adopt a position on it. We think reintegration is psychosocial. We think it's distinct from rehabilitation. And you'll see the model in a second to see our argument. It is an ongoing and dynamic process. It involves a bi-directional relationship between two parties, the offender, and you'll notice is struggling with X. Are they the ex-offender? Are they the offender? In the survey we put in, you know, it was like, let's ask 2,000 Victorians about this. What are your attitudes towards, hang on a second, what's that next word going to be? And we went, people with a criminal record. You know, and it was like, even that felt loaded and it's clunky and clumsy, but we thought, hey, if you call them offenders, we're sort of telling them the answer. We call them ex-offenders, we're telling them where we stand. You know, well, how do you do that with Keep It Clean? We think this process of reintegration is mediated by the ability and the readiness of both the individual and the community. You know, I used to live somewhere where the notion of giving help to any kind of offender was a misnomer overseas. And because the society itself in a developing country was struggling to work out basic things for people that weren't offenders. You know, despite the rhetoric, we aren't really in that position. But we shouldn't be anywhere near that position anyway. So what we have is community ability really mediating their preparedness to take part in programs that maybe assist certain groups. And it's not to deny there's many groups in our society who are disadvantaged, but what I was saying is we probably have the ability to fix it. And then we have, as the point was made earlier, the offenders, or the ex-offenders, the person with the criminal records, whoever they are, that person's ability and readiness as well.
Some of our service providers are also forced to look at a name change themselves because of the name that they've got. Like, I asked a question about ORGS in South Australia, the NSA Rehabilitation Services. Now, ORGS has done a rebadging and they basically just call themselves ORGS with no explanation of what it means. And what was the community connections? So now they become ORGS Community Connections. Nothing about offenders in prisons. It's rather interesting.
Yeah.
And you know, I mean, even my own organisation, we're even looking at that now because we're called Aboriginal Prisoners and Offender Support Services. And we're thinking of saying, well, we can't seem to find any acronym any explanation for the acronym APOS. Mm. So why don't we just call ourselves APOS? And it doesn't mean that is.
Yeah.
But we'll throw in a couple of other flash words.
Yeah.
Like diversity makes lifestyle changes possible.
Yeah. And you need to buy a veil for that one as well.
And can I just mention this other thing too, which is what I was going to just say before. I apologise for having a bit too much to say, but I'm passionate about this area. I spent most of my life as a teacher, and then I retired and then became involved in trying to assist and support people change their lives from different things that they got themselves into strife with. We hold, that is our Department of Corrections in South Australia, holds these meetings in every prison across the state once a year, called Royal Commission to Aboriginal Justice in Custody meetings. And when I first came on board about 8 years ago, we used to have the room packed full of service providers. Well, 8 years old, the prisoners come with all the same issues, and I'll tell you what, you could drop a bomb on the place and you wouldn't hurt the service provider. It would just be a room full of prisoners and poor old APOS sitting there. So I think, you know, again, this business of running with a rhetoric but not actually delivering is pretty painful for the people that we're trying to serve. And I just wonder why service providers, especially government service providers, come in and out of the action at, you know, the drop of a hat. And there's always a good explanation why they haven't been able to make a meeting. And I think that has a lot to do with this whole discussion about, you know, rehabilitation, reintegration,
yep.
And then how you model your services on that, so that you don't have to turn up into their office and the second question that you get, have you done any prison in your life, or have you ever offended? Because you wouldn't have those damn questions in your questionnaire, surely. Mm. Anyway.
And that, to me, is a signifier of one of the key points, and that is, yes, the terminology is old. Yes, we know everything goes in cycles, 3, 4, 5 years. The cycles are getting shorter, aren't they? But this is a flashpoint for reintegration. And if we get hold of it and get some terminological kind of clarity on this and get some momentum around it, we can do what rehabilitation did in the 80s. And rehabilitation did it because the people writing all the articles had a fundamentally vested interest in maintaining their careers, et cetera, right? That's fine. But that is one of the most coherent efforts to put something back on the table when an article came out that said it doesn't work, doesn't do anything. A government said, great, I'll take all the funding away from it and spend it on stuff that's much more popular. And these guys started publishing articles. Maybe it works a little. Maybe it works on a Friday. Maybe it works when you do this. Maybe it works when you do that. And all these articles started coming, they sort of thin on the ground, and then they got big, and then they got some data. And now it does look convincing, and now it is convincing. It's empirically convincing. Offender rehabilitation has a similar effect size to coronary bypass surgery. In terms of efficacy, I mean, that's pretty good, yeah? It's an accepted intervention, right? That's not me making stuff up. So, but there's a lot of psychosocial factors that also affect the effectiveness of heart surgery. There's a lot of psychosocial factors that affect this here. Our argument here is one that we say that reintegration is made up of domains of social inclusion, and you might come up with more domains. Housing, employment, interpersonal relationships, access to education and training, if you want it. Those are the four, under our argument, predominant parts of reintegration. I presented some stuff around this last year, and Terry O'Connell was here, and I put up a diagram that had reintegration, had housing, employment, and he said, no, I don't buy it. He said, I reckon you should put housing as a big circle because it affects employment, blah, blah, blah. And then I presented it at an employment conference, and they said, no, make employment the big circle because it affects everything, right? And if we're at a family conference, I'd say, no, make it big. So everyone wants to think that thing affects all the others. And of course they do, they're all two-way arrows. But we would say this thing called reintegration, this thing called assistance, are dependent on these domains of social inclusion. And that we think that these need to be present to a level that is subjectively adequate for the person. So you've got these guys have heard me say it before, but it's a very middle-class idea to say that your job must be really meaningful and blah, 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 blah. You know, lots of people have, and some of us aspire to, jobs that aren't necessarily that meaningful. We'd be happy just to clock off at 4:30 and not think about the bloody thing again, right? And that is kind of, that's different. And those people live, as some of us say, much happier lives than the rest of us.
because that stuff's not in the way. For some people, they just need a job that's a job. For some people, right? Others don't. You need it to be as meaningfully subjective, on a subjective level, as you need it to be. Right? But there are multiple levels of obstacles, and I'll show you a diagram in a second. At the policy level, these people can't work here. These people can't do that. These people can't do this for 3 years. You can't do that if you've done that. At the proximal level, I know that policy exists, but I wouldn't like to work with him. I know that policy exists, but I wouldn't like to live next to her. I know this is a proximal obstacle to reintegration. We can be as groovy as we want with policy, but if people on the ground aren't going to do whatever it is that they have to do, because this is the difference, every other goal of sentencing is outsourced by us, isn't it? Punishment. Can you handle that out there in 42 k's away in the distance, wherever it is that you go? Rehabilitation. Can you professionals handle that stuff for us? Community protection. Can you handle that? We're not allowed to do it ourselves. Deterrence. Can you make sure that happens, please? Denunciation. Can you make that symbolic comment for us, please? Reintegration. You want me to what? Yeah. You talking to me? What? Yeah. Me? What? You want me to what? Work with him? What? You know? Yeah. What do we all agree on? We had in common? Less offending, less re-offending, more community safety. Yeah. You want me to what? You know? This is it. It's up to you now. This is the stuff that the community doesn't get. This proximal obstacle we've also identified, as I've just touched on, a professional and organisational set of obstacles. They are reintegration and assistance are ongoing endeavours. They are related but never complete. This is our shot at a definition. Does that colour go through there? Reintegration is an ongoing... I'm going to make some editorial decisions, don't worry. Reintegration is an ongoing psychosocial process whereby opportunities for the offender, there's that term again, to construct functional, personally fulfilling... this is with big notes to Eileen Baldry as well, who's provided many of these phrases. Functional, personally fulfilling and responsible participation in wider society. But we added this bit. Are sought, presented and or obstructed. Reintegration is the process where these opportunities are sought, presented and or obstructed. This dynamic process involves the offender and the community to equal levels. It is bi-directional. The community must be ready and able. This is your words. The community must be ready and able to participate, to allow the offender, I like it, to participate at an equivalent level to other law-abiding citizens. I just want to play a role. I just want to hang around in the room with other non-smokers. You know what I mean? I just want to join in. It's that line from Taxi Driver. I just want to be a person like other people. And the offender must be ready and able to participate in society as a law-abiding citizen. You can see this lens goes both ways. I'm not blaming society, and many people in the room get shirty about that. When are they going to take some individual responsibility? Yada, yada, yada. And you can say, well, listen, we've got the spotlight on both. Here's our model. It looks filthy, but I'm going to walk us through it. And this is the group that's worked with me on that. Delene's here, that's Brookstein. Let's have a look at this term re-entry. We thought about it, we're interested in it. Well, in order to get some clarity for us, you know, we decided that re-entry was, we're going to call re-entry this moment or moments where your level of correctional involvement changes. If I go from, I don't know what your divisions are in your jurisdictions, but if I go from J division max to H division minimum, this is one process of re-entry for me in prison. They give me a little bit of a longer lead. Re-enter mainstream. Re-enter do that.
Getting classified is a form of re-entry.
That's what we would argue. Right. Because they're giving you a shot at it. They aren't they? They're saying,
a little bit more trust for you.
Let's see how you go. Re-entry is this tiered process. You get out on intensive parole. In Victoria, you have 3 months in intensive for the first period, right? You can't scratch yourself without, you know, having to tell somebody or whatever, right? There's a big re-entry back to the community. Big adjustment for those who work with those clients, aren't they? They are under the hammer like nobody else, those guys, are they? And they've got an 80% failure rate. Then they move to normal parole, again, highly supervised. Then that ends at some point. We would argue that if you're on an intensive corrections order, what we have, which is our highest community-based order in Victoria, and you end that's also a process of re-entry. So we're not just talking about walking out of prison walls, we're talking about changing your level of correctional involvement, because all of those things are giving you a longer lead. And they involve you confronting different decisions. On parole, you have restrictions about where you can live, and then you don't. So then you're going to start to fill in different forms and come across different barriers and different obstacles. So we talk about reentry as that point there, and we also talk about, where's my arrow? This thing here, the rehabilitation happens while you're in the correctional system. Right? If once you have re-entered and you are clean of that stuff, we now the final process of re-entry, we would argue rehabilitation, whether it hit, whether it missed, whether you got it or whether you didn't, has had its shot. In Victoria, we have a system where, and a lot of you guys will as well, the high-risk offenders get intensive programming, the medium-risk gets some rehabilitation program, the low-risk get none. The low-risk get none. They don't, they're not seen as rehabilitation worthy. They don't get any rehabilitation programs, right? They only get the social stuff. And, you know, and in Victoria, any Victorian, not seeing any faces I recognise, but in Victoria, they recently looked at their numbers and went, we're not getting enough, what are they doing? Not getting enough medium-risk violent people into programs. And so instead of creating more programs, they changed the risk score. Can you see that? Yeah, that was kind of a little wacky, wasn't it?
Who does the risk assessment so that they get high risk people into the program?
That's a good body of literature at the moment for a student with a PhD in that, just, which is like that notion of, well, what about my past? Is that going to predict my future? What about my personal scripts of change, etc.? And how are they being assessed in those instruments? Answer, not at all.
Yeah.
So there's the beginning of our model. We talk about re-entry, and I'm going to whiz through it. When were you looking? When was I meant to be done?
Yeah.
Righto. And in closing, righto. I really can get it done though in kind of a short period of time. So the role of the community, we said, what just happened there? Re-entry, right? You've entered the community, and now it's about the community's ability and resources to play a role for you, and that will influence their readiness, and their readiness will influence how much they make this stuff available to you, our domains of social acceptance. But how much their ability and their readiness makes these things available to you or not is influenced primarily by a whole systematic set of obstacles. And these obstacles, as we said, exist. And every one of these domains has obstacles in place in every Australian jurisdiction. There are policy obstacles that get in my way to get housing. There are professional policy obstacles. There are informal professional discretionary obstacles. And there are personal proximal obstacles from you and I about how we feel about doing X and Y. And they exist at every stage. And we've got, for example...
And it's different for every type of offence, too.
Absolutely.
You know, so it might be okay for an armed robber to come live next door to me, but if it's a sex offender, I'm going to go to the media, you know, and... protest and pickets and all the rest of it.
And there was that moment that I, you know, dined out on many times with the students over the year at last year's conference, and I started to talk about some of the research we're doing, which was looking at what type of offenders the community are amenable to, and we had a lot of people in the room who were ex-prisoners, etc., and, you know, they started throwing grenades at me, and I said, oh, you know, we don't like this notion of you partitioning a group, etc., and I said, okay, let me just ask you one question. Are there any offender groups that you wouldn't want to live next door to? And they went, bloody oath, I'm not stupid. And then, you know, and it was like a fascinating kind of argument. And it was like we're all in agreement around that. Again, we worked out what we agreed with in terms of broader notions so that we could get through some of the BS, you know, language stuff, right?
It's interesting that you talk about them having an opinion, because I run a workshop with a group of mainstream guys up at Barwon, and they have the most black and white opinions about what should happen to sex offenders. It's not even funny. And when they literally will sit there and say to you, don't throw away the key, lock, I don't care. And I said to them, but it's not black and white. And we discussed, you know, what if they're a young person, what if they're an older person, what if there's that age gap, what about the law, and no, black and white, throw away the key, exactly. Don't care.
And that's that kind of, what do they call that? Selective morality in prisons. You know, that's that notion of the continuum and the sliding scale, and where do you sit personally, and who, and, you know, who do you feel are comfortable doing what with and when kind of thing, which is what we're all about with this research. Here's one of our, these are very much under construction, these tables, but this is like us trying to document what those obstacles look like across maybe just one of the domains, and I think that was housing from memory, but, you know, there are some boxes that don't necessarily apply to all levels. And then we looked at their rationale. rationale behind it might be community safety. It might be a risk reduction in ways that aren't necessarily related to their offence, you know, like managing organisational risk. And it might be this notion of once you've done X, you've forfeited your right to Y. You know that stuff that says, oh, no, you did that in the past. I'm not interested in that. Where do we hear this stuff now? I heard this all night last night on TV and that Australian story before Q&A and then Q&A. They talk about it all the time in relation to refugees now. And you talk to people in the public, don't they? And they say, look, I'm all for helping out refugees as long as they follow the official channels. You know what I mean? And it's like, okay, what's the official channel look like? You know, 5,000 forms. No, I don't like the ones that jump the queue. All these notions about what's legitimate and what isn't and how you do it. And the other place we really see it, which is interesting, is people make medical boards, talking about ethics committees, making decisions about who's eligible for transplants. What was that? You used to be a smoker. You know what I mean? It's like, what's the narrative there? You contributed to the problem that you've got. What's the narrative?
Ask me for a lung transplant.
Exactly.
You're responsible. You can't go into
my class forensically.
We've agreed on that. Yes, that's right. We're in the same boat. We're both missing out because there used to be the medical ethics argument that said, well, they've contributed. They have what's called achieved stigma. They've contributed to this thing the problem that they've got. Therefore, maybe we get someone that never smoked. You know, they're more eligible. I'm trying to work out housing. Maybe let's get someone that hasn't offended. Let's sort all of them out first. Then we'll go back to the offenders because the offenders should keep going to the back of the queue. And you go, yeah, but hang on. They're just as need. They're just as this. They're that. They're this. There's bigger social imperatives that we can meet. Really loaded up. Really complex.
You want housing? Well, just put them back into prison.
Exactly.
We're already out.
Yeah.
There.
Or can't we build us a big block where we put them all together? Yeah. Won't that be a good idea? Yeah. Yeah.
You were on Cat One once. Yeah. You come in for your interview. We've just noticed you missed your last appointment. Where was I?
Yeah.
There's an interesting article in this month's Monthly written by Andrew Fraser, the ex-lawyer.
Yeah, the Hollywood guy. Yeah.
And he says, whatever you think of him, he says a lot about not being able to practice law and still paying and when does it stop
yes.
and all those other things. Whatever you think of him, it's
yes.
a really interesting
yep.
article to look at. In theory, we say you pay back society, but when does it finish?
Mm-hmm.
And that's from someone who you would not consider with background issues and literacy and all
yes.
that
you
talked
about. Yeah, that. Yeah. That's, and for some reason it's those ones that see kind of almost professional or white collar when they make those arguments that it seems to resonate more because they can express it differently, can't they? And they get into forums like the Monthly, etc. You know, there's been a few. It's a mate of his actually, a well-known forensic psychologist who was involved with exactly the same stuff that Andrew Fraser was at the time and in criminal conviction and then went for a re-registration and the board gave it to him actually, and a lot of people were very righteous about it, you know, and I used to say in class, well, hang on a second, you guys, you work in offender rehabilitation, why are you so amped up about this guy being allowed to practice in your field? Oh, I shouldn't be allowed to practice in our field, it's only, but, you know what I mean, like, so what, don't you believe in what you do? Didn't you change anybody? Can't you fix anybody? Can't anybody change? What are we doing in here? You know, it's like that, but that got tied up with all that kind of in-group, out-group, we're holier than thou, we're psychologists, BS, that doesn't impress me at any level. But, somebody talked about community readiness in here earlier today, my spies tell me, and there is a community readiness model that is being talked about in Canada or the US, in the US, and it is... they talk about it's a way to look at how ready a community is for something, and we certainly use this model and the references there, and Miriam will have these slides. I have no problem with sharing those with you, so she'll have them on the site. You can use those as frameworks as well. But we're looking, how ready is the community anyway for this stuff? Are they aware of a problem of reoffending? Absolutely. Are they accurately informed? Not really. Would accurate knowledge help them get through some of these stages and get them to vague awareness about the realities? Yeah, it would. Can we rely on the media to do that? No, we can't. So how do we do that? And this is the stuff, a fundamental failure of media is, you know, very relevant to this argument. Briefly, and I'm not going to tell you anything about findings, but for those of you who aren't already aware of our study, we have done the biggest study into community views into reintegration in Australia, if not the world, and it asks who is in favour of what with whom. What parts of the community? Is it gender effect? Is there an age effect? If you've been a victim of crime, what did your findings tell us? Just that was wild. I love that finding. Victims of crime are the least fearful group?
No, people who've never been a victim.
Yeah.
The most
fearful of anybody.
People have never been victims of crime are more fearful than any victims of crime about it.
Yeah, makes sense.
Why does it make sense?
Like fear of the unknown.
Is there really fear of the unknown?
Yes.
Fear of the unknown.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because the only thing they see on the front page of the paper is that everyone at Bala gets steak and
yes.
Well, thank you for dinner.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And so the ones that have perhaps had some contact with the system can see the subtleties as well and can see the nuance. Any stuff about attitudes in this area always brings up a big curve, right? Most surveys bring up a nice straight line, you know, normal kind of, or actually a normal reaction like this. These things always go the other way. There's people on this extreme, no way! And there's a whole bunch of people on this extreme, no problem! And then there's very few in the middle in relation to some things. And it's about these extreme views, and what you find is similar factors predict the extreme views, and that is kind of poor information, etc., etc. The more information you get about this stuff, the more uncertain you get about it. The more you can see the vague. Well, hang on, but then he said, but this, well, what about that, and what about this, and what about that? Other people are very vehement in their views, whether it's either side or not. Anyway, we've done this study, and we've got a whole bunch of findings. What have I got here?
Can I just make a comment on that?
Sure.
Something like I've done in the community and trying to get ex-offenders involved in community activities that aren't specific. I've come across quite strong anti-offender positions, but they seem to be quite brittle. Like, it doesn't actually take much before they completely break down. So
what does it take?
Well, personal exposure to someone they know is an offender. So even people who work with public housing residents or community housing, where you know that there's probably 40% of the people that have been to prison, people working there don't know them as offenders, and so they're still scared about client groups who we're saying are offenders.
Yeah.
But they actually know them as people,
it's different. Yeah, it breaks it down straight away.
So it's that label of
offender.
It's so scary.
Yeah. Absolutely. Good old labeling theory. And is that familiarity that's been a massive factor in the study? Are you aware of an offender as offender? People say, yeah, just seem to be more into that middle group about, yeah, but it seems to depend on a whole bunch of things, you know? It moves them into that thinking level about it, doesn't it? As someone said to me when they heard this presentation the other day, it moves them to the cognitive level. They think about it instead of being emotional about it.
Yeah.
Well, maybe something like racism seems to hold a lot stronger.
Yes.
So the first people they met
would
be an exception, and the subsequent were exceptions,
whereas
I just think most
seems
more brittle.
Yeah, it reminds me of, I love it when I see this stuff in movies. Having said that, I can't remember the movie. I can't remember the woman. She speaks in French. She's an English actress, but she speaks in French in this movie, and she's been inside for, it's going to be a spoiler moment, killing her child. Can't remember anyway. She goes for employment on the way out. It's cloud of mystery, and she gets a groovy employer, and he says, yeah, that's all fine, blah, blah, blah. And he says, you know, we're progressive here, which is, and by the way, what did you do? And she tells him, he says, get out of here. Leave now. You know what I mean? Because what the offence that she talked about exceeded his personal threshold of what
taboo.
It was. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's right. And
like
sex
offender.
Exactly.
It doesn't matter what type of sex offender you know. Necessarily, if you're labelled that,
that's
it. Regardless of whether you looked at kiddie porn or adult porn or whatever you did, or bestiality, or you did actually a physical act, doesn't matter what spectrum that is, once that label's on, it's such a taboo.
Yeah. Yeah. And that group is always at these. The community is more opposed to anything with those groups, sex offending groups, than they are with any other offender, murderers or anything else. But they do divide between them, but for whatever rationales. So you can see the kinds of questions we're exploring. Are you in favour of living next door to someone who's been convicted of a property offence? Are female community members okay about living next door to someone who's committing a corporate crime? I'm not going to do this stuff. Skipping, 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 skipping. Probably skipping that as well. What am I going to talk about with housing? Oh, do you want to see some of that? On average, how willing are you to support government policy for ex-offender housing? You know, real fair to middling, 4 out of 7 on average. The average is 4 out of 7 in terms of like, look, they're not dead set against it. But what about when you say to them, okay, well, how willing are you to live next door to an ex-offender? You can look at that and go, oh, it's only 4 to 3. But when you've got 2,500 people, that's a hugely statistically significant difference, right, on a scale of 1 to 7.
when you consider most people don't say one, most people say seven, you know, you've got this kind of difference. So that's really indicative of the data. The policy proximity divide, we call it. And look at the policy proximity divide in action here. When you ask people about, just look at that end one there, the one that's a different colour. That's a question that says, do you think society should help offenders? Just any kind of offender. We go, yeah. Look how kind of, you know, relatively, they're all into it. And do you think you could help them? Oh, yeah, okay. This policy proximity divide exists everywhere. And you can see people have differential levels of support for policy according to offender type and differential levels of support on proximal level for... And, you know, you can highlight all kinds of things. You know, the group that probably does the most social harm, the corporate investment crime people, they're the ones, yeah, I'd rent my house to him, no problem. You know what I mean? They're the reason why we're all lost our superannuation. But no problem. I'm going to give you some financial advice.
They impact so many more
people. Exactly.
Like investment crime.
Yes, that's it. Well, this is a weird notion, isn't it? As we move further down our model, so you can see what our research is doing. It's drilling into that part of the model that says, what are the obstacles on the policy and proximity level, and how do we get through those? How ready is the community, etc.? So just to complete the model for you, we move through these personal thresholds and subjective perceptions of how much housing, employment, or whatever I got, you know. Did I get enough for me? I got through all those obstacles. How do I feel about getting through this model now? And you notice, by the way, we haven't mentioned the client yet, the offender, the ex-offender. They haven't come into play at all in this model. Only now are they starting to get into it. So over here on the left, we have reintegrative factors. My personal ability to work on reintegration, you know, the world won't come to me. And my personal readiness to work on reintegration, and those two things are interactive. I also think, and we also think, these things interact with a personal ability to work on desistance, because we would say they are separate constructs. I can stop offending and not necessarily feel reintegrated. I can reintegrate and still offend for some other reason. Not everyone offends because they weren't reintegrated, yeah. Right?
And are we reintegrating into the whole community or just into my offending community?
Yeah.
I can get out of jail and get back with all my mates and, yeah, my family's okay and, you know, be accepted in my world.
Yes.
But my world is this.
Yeah.
And the community is that.
That's right. And because of that and my efforts of desistance...
not integrated.
Yes. And I feel integrated. I don't know, because my mate gave me a job and I got this and I got that. And that's all great. But I'm probably going to re-offend because I'm in that scene.
Yes.
So even though I ticked a reintegration box on that personal subjective level, I still re-offended. And we might go, wow, he ticked all the boxes in the program. How does this work? You know, this works somehow differently because we think this is separate. Oh, by the way, we did make this point that we deliberately made the... Where is the... He says... Oh, there it is, down here, coming up. Sorry, box down here. So the ongoing process of reintegration desistance, we didn't run out of room on the page. We left the boxes open-ended because you aren't a desister until you're in the ground. It's an ongoing process. You are not an ex-smoker. If you have the odd one, then it's okay. You might smoke less, etc., etc. But it's an ongoing process for us. Every day we think about it. And every day we decide whether we'll have one. And that's okay. I'd like to put myself in the group of the non-smokers, etc., but if I go, officially, this person will never smoke again, I'm jumping the gun. I really am. So there's our model, there's our research around it. These guys have done some great contributions to it as well. And hopefully you can see we're trying to get some clarity around some concepts and some processes of change so we can just try and move this area forward a little, because at the moment it's in danger of disappearing down some kind of whatever those things are called. Thanks, guys.
Please never let us
suffer
clients see all those barriers
later. Exactly. Yeah.